Welcome to Humans Invent Cycling Podcast. I'm Richard Moore and I'm with Lionel Burney.
Hi Richard.
Very enthusiastic, Lionel. I'm waving. Is it because we're getting close to Christmas?
It is, yeah.
And Daniel Freeb.
Hello Richard.
And Ian Cleverley from Ruler Magazine. Ian Cleverley. So, welcome to our review of the 2013 season. We're going to do this in several categories. We've got Rider of the Year, Race of the Year, Story of the Year, and Confession of the Year.
Podcast of the Year.
Yeah, we could. And I know you guys have all been doing a lot of homework for this, a lot of preparation. Lionel, is that you scrolling through your phone? Are you looking for inspiration?
I am.
I'll not come to you first then. Daniel.
What?
Daniel, what's your Race of the Year?
Oh, it's definitely not San Remo. It was fabulous, wasn't it? No?
Yeah, it was a bit curtailed.
Yeah, and it was a complete shambles in a lot of respects because it was curtailed and there was a long stoppage, wasn't it? Then the riders had to get in buses because it was so cold, the weather was so awful.
My favourite tweet, though, was Roger De Vlaming.
But that's not Roger De Vlaming, it's a fake.
Is it not really Roger De Vlaming?
No, I'm pretty sure it's not.
It was somebody
like
about oh my god, the rider. What a shame, the writers are so cold they can't even tweet anymore. Their fingers were so frozen they couldn't tweet anymore. Is that not really Roger De Vlaming?
That's definitely not Roger De Vlaming.
Well, you know Roger De Vlaming quite well, don't you?
Relatively, spent a day with him. But yes.
Milan San Remo.
Milan San Remo. And yeah, so the riders were kind of decanted about 80 kilometres from the finish, I seem to remember, or just before the Cappy anyway. And then we got a completely different race. But really, I think the race was almost decided in those moments when they were in the buses and each team's having conversations about who was going to start, who was not going to start. And the three of Mark Cavendish's teammates, not really domestiques, because it was Nicky Terpstra, Tom Boonen and Steen van der Bogt, decided not to restart. And I think, really, those decisions cost him what is likely to be his last chance to win Milan-San Remo with the route change. He didn't know that at the time, of course, but I think he was pretty miffed. I think he talks about it in his book, actually. I think he was pretty miffed. I think certain members of the team staff were perhaps a little bit puzzled as to why those guys didn't restart. I know some riders during that stoppage were literally trembling with cold and were really in a bad way. But yeah, certainly that had a major, major impact on the outcome of the race. But I think everyone who finished that day was absolutely heroic and a really fantastic race all round, as it always is.
Ian, what is your race of the year this year?
Well, I'm going to annoy the hell out of all of you because it's a cyclocross race.
What?
I'm sorry, this is a cycling podcast.
Yes.
You didn't know that.
A cyclocross race.
You did study the terms and conditions before you came.
But no. It's not a British cyclocross race. You can't have a British cyclocross race.
Well, I could,
like
but it's not.
Daniel also went for a cyclocross race.
Well, that's true,
actually. Argue the case for cyclocross. What race was it?
It was Zonhoven. It was 2 weeks ago, maybe 3 weeks ago. Now, the Brits go crazy over Coxsider. For various reasons, mostly because it's on
before the water.
Don't they just?
Mostly because it's on the same weekend as the Gen 6, so you can do a weekend. You go over, you do the cross and the Gen 6. That's a top weekend, and everybody goes on about how fantastic Coxsider is. Actually, it's okay. It's not that great. It's got one long sort of sand gym that they have to yomp across. Apart from that, you know, it's all right. Zonhoven takes them up sand dunes, down sand dunes. But the beauty of it was you had the new Dutch kid on the block, Lars van der Haar, who was absolutely fantastic. You've got him that's gone herring off at the start. Sven Nys, good old Sven, world champion, he's nowhere to be seen. He's not even in the top 10 in the first lap. And in cross, that's generally, you know, it's generally game over. But with a course like that, it's such a selection. The cream rises to the top, so it ends up at the front. You've got Van der Haar, you've got the Belgian champion Claes Vanzenhout, you've got Niels Albert, former world champion, and then eventually, and Sven Nys takes, it's not until the last lap that he finally makes contact with the lead, and then he wins the sprint. It's just absolute consummate performance. And the people were starting to go, well, Sven, even though he's world champion, he'd had a sort of quiet start to the season. They were thinking, oh, maybe he's had it now. And that showed just...
So you recommend it. Final race of the year.
Well, I was just going to stick up for Ian a bit on cyclocross. Despite the fact that only about 12 people do it, it is absolutely brilliant. It's only an hour and a bit long, so everyone can concentrate for that long. And I think the atmosphere at some of these events, the one at Koppenberg is incredible as well. Midweek race, and it seems like everybody's taking a day off. And they go up the road and then round and in the field and then up the field and then round and then up the road again. It's just, it is great fun. The atmosphere is fantastic.
Yeah,
personally, I think it's got a lot more going for it than mountain biking, which is like watching paint dry.
Not downhill mountain biking. No. Downhill mountain biking is very exciting to watch.
Yeah, okay, I'll concede that, yeah.
Anyway, what's your race of the year?
Am I allowed to choose an individual stage from a...
Yeah, well, that's what I was going to do, and you're probably going to pick the same one.
Well, I don't know, because I don't think you saw this one, really.
Yeah, well, in that case, it is the one I was going to pick. Go for it.
It's the crosswind stage from the Tour de France to Saint-Amand-Montrond, which was just captivating viewing from the moment we got to the press room in that funny kind of whatever place that is. It's weird. They always have it there, don't they?
Pyramid, yeah. And the buffet there is always memorable. They always just spit roast the cow, don't they?
Yeah,
a whole cow.
I missed the entire buffet because I couldn't stop watching what was going on. It was extraordinary.
Yeah.
It must have been for you to miss the buffet.
Indeed, yeah. It was one of those stages where no one really kind of knew what was going on, and you were sort of piecing it together from the commentary and from from just what was on the screen, and trying to work out the motivations of each different team. There were several teams that had something to gain or lose, most notably Saxo Bank, who wanted to try and gain a bit of time for Contador, Amiga Pharma, who wanted to try and get Cavendish into that final split, and obviously Sky, who were on the back foot because Froome missed the crucial split. But I think I spoke to Brian Holm recently about it, and he said it is the outstanding day that he will remember forever as a director sportif, simply because of the decisions that the riders took pretty much on their own in those split seconds. Mm. For example, the Polish rider,
Kwiatkowski,
he kind of gave Cavendish either a push or a bit of a hand swing to get him across the gap, just as the crosswinds were really causing havoc.
I'm not sure it says that in Cavendish's book, or
is
not?
Is that right?
I'm not sure about
it. Doesn't actually glosses over that
push,
because that,
was
you
it?
Know,
but well, there was a bit of a backlash, wasn't there, because it's against the rules.
It was Froome that said he'd got a hand swing, because Froome was just behind them at the time, and he was left behind. You almost forget that Cavendish won that stage. You know, it was such a good stage that it's almost the quality of the stage almost overshadowed the fact that he won it, and won it in outstanding fashion.
It was a finish the way that they had, because they had three riders in the finish, and obviously Cavendish, the hot favourite to win the sprint from that group, but they didn't leave anything to chance. They could have just...
Well, because Sagan had a man there, and what was it, Chavanel? They sent Chavanel attacked in the final kilometer to force
Terpstra.
Yeah. And then Chavanel gave him a lead out, didn't he? Yeah.
And it was just one of those days when bike racing is always at its best when the moment of the race is not telegraphed. So yeah, we all get excited about the summit finish, and we all kind of mentally switch on when they reach the bottom of the final mountain, and then we watch 35 or 45 minutes of climbing and expect the fireworks. But cycling, road racing, is always at its best when the moments happen when you least expect it.
It's the unpredictability of crosswinds, isn't it?
Yeah, that's wonderful. And the sheer aesthetic, the sight of the helicopter shot. Yeah, splitting into echelons and fanning across the road, and it's wonderful. These gaps look so small, but you know that they are unclosable at that point.
And the great thing about that particular stage as well was that the crosswinds themselves were not telegraphed in the sense that, well, it just showed up how little we sometimes know as journalists, because no one had really called it among the journalists. I think a few direct sportifs were aware for a few days before this, a few months.
What struck me later that day was just a memory of something I witnessed in Tour, where I think you were in Tour, Ian. Okay. I think I remember bumping into you in Tour. Mm-hmm. And at the start, I remember being struck by the very sort of jovial spirits of the Movistar riders who went to sign on together, and they were joking around and riding back to their team bus and bumping shoulders and just playing the fool, really. And those were the guys that were caught out that day. And I'm not saying there was any connection there, but when I thought about it later, I just contrasted that their high spirits with this image, which might not have been true, of Belkin and Quickstep on their team buses, kind of plotting the day ahead.
You do occasionally see that. It always makes me think of the 1971 stage, Rich, that I think you've just written about for a forthcoming book, where Lewis Ocaña was kind of locking around before a stage start, and Eddie Merckx, I think Eddie Merckx already had the plan to attack him on a descent. It was a descending finish. But you do see that occasionally, guys. Mm-hmm. You know, I was speaking to Gianni Savia the other day, and he says he always drums into his riders before almost every day of racing that it's not a second's inattention that can cost you, it's a milliseconds. And you really have to be switched on at all times. And I think some guys at times are not perhaps that switched on at the start of races.
Well, that was going to be my selection, but I'll go instead for a stage that at the time I thought was going to be the outstanding stage of the tour, to Bagnères de Bigorre, the stage 9, second day in the Pyrenees, that Dan Martin won for Garmin Sharp. And it was as much for the implosion of Team Sky, who the previous day, Taxe Trois Domaines, had looked as though they were going to control the race in the way that they did in 2012. And the next day, they fell apart under the combined pressure of Movistar being very aggressive and Garmin Sharp also being very, very aggressive. And that stage had everything. Peter Kenyuk falling into a ditch.
Punch up between Mark Cavendish and Juan Jose Lobato.
Didn't know about that.
Escotel. Daniel. Oh, it's documented in his book, Rich.
Oh, my God. Right, well, I'll must reread that book.
You're mentioned.
There's only one bit in that book that really caught my eye. But yeah, it was a thrilling stage. It was a thrilling stage and a very well executed win by Dan Martin. And that's quite a nice link, because we do have a little interview with Dan Martin here. I spoke to Dan recently, and he reflected on what has been his best season and looked ahead to next year and the possibility of perhaps riding the Giro instead of the Tour. So here's Dan Martin. I guess you're contemplating the off season now. You're going to take a bit of time off next year, 2014. A lot of people talking about you and the Giro next year. Is that a race that sort of figures quite prominently in your thoughts for next year?
It's not that I don't specific targets, but I'm starting now to base my race program at all the races that I can actually do well in. So for me, I mean, this year, Catalunya. I didn't start the season thinking, I really want to win Catalunya. I'm going to focus my whole strength on Catalunya. You end up winning, and I think if you look too far ahead and focus too far ahead, you miss opportunities that can be way closer. I love racing my bike, so I mean, it's better to. I'm just going to race as hard as I can each week, and my form and my training will be building up towards the Ardennes and the Giro. But there's no small races in cycling anymore. No. I think you're seeing that in the fatigue of the peloton. Every race is hard, and every race is a huge victory. So,
is it feasible though that you would prioritise the Giro over the Tour? You know, is that could that be a bigger aim for you next year, do you think?
Yeah, because it comes first.
But the aim would be to ride both.
I'm not sure yet. I mean, I think you have to decide that after the Giro to see how you feel. I mean, you saw this year all the guys who did the Giro were pretty cooked at the Tour, and the Giro is a really hard race in itself, and it's an incredibly prestigious race in itself. So it's I'll get through the Giro, and then we'll see how we feel for the Tour. But it's at the moment it's like my season effectively finishes after the Giro and for the rest of the year.
You were obviously in great form at the Tour this year, but. You were unlucky. I think you fell ill towards the end of the race. So GC became not a realistic goal for you. But looking at these Grand Tours, do you see yourself emerging as a GC rider over the next couple of years?
Now, this year I was in the top 10 before I got sick, and there's only 3 mountain days left. And my form was getting better and better. And this year's tour really gave me the confidence that I can compete in a Grand Tour. Will I can win the Tour of France? I don't know. I didn't really imagine winning the Age Plus on the Age, you know. So surprises always get thrown up. I enjoyed the tour a lot more this year than last year, and I think that's because I was stronger mentally more than anything. Proved to myself that I can race really hard every day. I got through 18 days, so for 21 days it wouldn't be a problem. It's just the fact that I got sick towards the end.
It must be nice getting the stage win quite early as well, because that was in the bank.
Took a lot of pressure off the whole team, and from then on anything else was a bonus in the race. And obviously the way the race panned out, it was lucky that we got it early on, because we were pretty cooked towards the end, but it's obviously Andrew picked it up towards the end and finished in the top 10 on GC. But yeah, the stadium was incredible. And it was just another peak. It must have been a crazy year.
Any thoughts on next year's tour? Have you looked at that? It was obviously announced this week. You've been in Japan, but have you any thoughts on it? Any stages that stand out for you for next year?
appearing in Insiders again. I mean, they're really, yeah, they suit me really well. They're short. Well, normally I like longer races, but the shorter distance and the explosiveness of the stages is going to be really exciting racing. I think the Tour have done a really good job of making exciting routes. There's no time trial towards the end. I mean, there's guys going to be on pretty much the same time for a long periods of the race, especially in the first week or so. But it's going to make it a really nervous race, and I'm not sure that's going to suit me. You know, the cold zones and all the nerves in the first week as far as fighting for position. On paper, if I was going to go ride the Tour route on my own this week, or next month, it's maybe an easier route, but it's the riders that make the race, and it's going to be an incredibly challenging parkour next year.
So what happens now, Dan? What's the off-season like for you?
Yeah, it's mostly just relaxing and seeing family for the next couple of weeks, and then family and friends, and relaxing Girona and start my training again early December, and just slowly build up.
You've got family in Girona now as well, haven't you?
Mom and dad live in Girona now. They're running a little business for me, like renting holiday apartments. So it's nice to have them around, and obviously dad helps with training and the motor pacing and picking me up from the airport. So but it's just, yeah, I've built my own little world in Girona now. It makes it more comfortable, and obviously it's a beautiful place to live too, so I'm happy for them.
I mean, it's only a few days ago that you stopped racing, but have you been able to reflect already on your season? It's really been a huge season for you, hasn't it?
It's been a long season, and I've stepped up psychologically because I've been able to focus and take on the pressure of team leader pretty much every race I've ridden, and I mean, that's why I'm pretty cooked now. I mean, Beijing was hard mentally to be able to stay focused, and it's not a question of motivation, it's just a question of psychological fatigue as far as hurting myself. I just didn't want to go hard anymore. My body just said, my head said no, you know. I managed to get through it, and to top Beijing off and coming so close to the win, I mean, that would be an awesome way to finish the year. But it's the consistency I've shown this year makes me more proud than the victories almost, because I seem to have arrived at a level that makes me competitive week in, week out.
You feel like you stepped up a level, really?
Yeah, it's a slow progression that I've seen year on year, and hopefully that's it now. We're up at that level. And
is there something that changed, something you did, something that happened this year? That was it just age, or did you do anything differently coming into the season? Can you put your finger on anything that changed for you?
I definitely trained harder last year, but it wasn't through wanting to train harder, or it just happened. We were riding the Tour last year in less than peak condition. I mean, I didn't realise it at the time that I wasn't in good form. I thought I was going really well, but looking back now, obviously with the crash of the Dauphiné, my body wasn't quite working properly, and to get through the Tour I was sick as well at the Tour last year, so to get through the Tour in that situation, I think really it made my body take on an extra couple of cc's, you know, and my engine's grown, and I definitely felt that in the winter, because I could just, my endurance increased. And I think it's also a case of year on year as a cyclist. I mean, that's why guys, everybody says it's once you get into your 30s, it's your peak years. And I think it's true, because I mean, every year you've got an extra 30,000 kilometres on the clock, and it's only naturally you're going to get stronger. And it's also the psychological development that I'm very much benefiting from this year. I think I'm a lot stronger and just more confident in taking on the pressure of the team. It isn't so much self-belief that I've gained, but it's more the ability to take on the responsibility.
The Humans Invent Cycling Podcast. Interviews and analysis. We've got the big talking points covered.
That was Dan Martin we heard from there. So next category, fellas, Rider of the Year. Who's your Rider of the Year? Ian.
Marianne Vos.
Oh.
She just wins at whatever she does, and for her, I think a relatively quiet year in the number of wins, but that still makes her road world champion, cross world champion. What else did she bag? Flanders, Flesh Wallonne.
And she did a bit of mountain biking this year.
Mountain biking just for kicks. So yeah, hats off to her. And a great little. Did you know if you saw the interview this week that Kenny Pride did with her?
Mm-hmm. We've got an interview with her actually coming up on the pod at the end of this little section.
I was just interested by the bit where she said that that Rabobank basically gave her about 5 minutes notice that they were pulling the plug on sponsoring the team.
Yeah,
and then she was surrounded by TV crews and journalists going, "So, what's the story?" I mean, that's just so disrespectful. So disrespectful.
But no, a good choice. Met her a couple of weeks ago at the Braveheart dinner in Scotland, and she was a fantastic star guest. And I did speak to her there, and we've got an interview with her, which we'll play at the end of this Rider of the Year segment. Daniel, Rider of the Year.
I mean, there were a lot of good ones this year, weren't there? There were a lot of outstanding individual performances from Rui Costa winning two stages at the Tour to the Worlds, Rodriguez, consistent as always, Cancellara, two classics. I think Cancellara's achievements this year have been overlooked, really. They've been overshadowed by that fantastic sequence that Froome had where he almost mimicked Wiggins' 2012 season. So I'll say Cancellara just because... I wouldn't say he was written off by some people, but he didn't have a good classic season last year, and also he showed some real kind of progress in terms of the way he's reading races.
Yeah, and Paris-Roubaix.
Yeah, I mean, he's often been most vulnerable when he's at strongest. He's almost too strong sometimes, and it scares other riders into not working for him. Having said that, I think he might not have won Paris-Roubaix if Stibar hadn't crashed.
Due to his silky cyclocross skills, which was pretty well. I mean, that was how he held that up was...
He could be the future winner, the Classics next year, in the Cobble Classics.
Definitely. Lionel, Rider of the Year.
Well, I'll have to go for the obvious. Really.
I go last every time, and I'm... Well, you go for it.
I was going to go for the obvious, though. I'll leave you with some searching around to do, but it's got to be Chris Froome, hasn't it? I mean, as Daniel says, he very nearly sort of mimicked Bradley Wiggins' perfect kind of hopscotch from the Springs through to the Tour de France, but for one day when they messed up really in Tirreno, didn't they? Froome kind of probably only moment of inattention really all year, but he won. Tour of Oman, I think he won Criterium International. Richie Port won Paris-Nice while Froome was trying to win Tirreno, and I think he was still on the podium, wasn't he? Or fourth Froome at Tirreno. And then through Romandie, the Dauphiné and the Tour de France. I mean, that kind of, when Bradley Wiggins did that, you thought, well, that won't be done again because it's never been done before. And then Froome went and did it the next year, and I think if you credit Froome for that, you also have to credit the team because they've got that stage racing blueprint down to a T, and where it's about minimising mistakes rather than capitalising on opportunity. Sky are very, very good, and probably why they're not quite so clinical in one day races, where it's more about creating opportunities and seizing the moment. But when they're in that mode of just how to work back from winning a stage race and minimising their mistakes, they're very good at it.
Yeah, they are so firmly in that groove now, and they know how to execute that perfectly. But by the same token, it'll be interesting to see whether, you know, next year the other teams have had 2 years of looking at that, observing it and identifying the weaknesses of that approach now. And I think we saw glimpses of that at the Tour de France, sort of the stage that Rich mentioned, the Bagnères de Bigorre. That was a good example of perhaps a weakness having been identified, and it'll be interesting to see whether.
And it's funny, I mean, also how Sky would respond if they didn't tick off all those races, you know, and the chances of them continuing in that vein are probably slight. So if at some point he loses a key build-up race, either Dauphiné or Romandie, you know, what then? How then that might alter the Tour and going in as a favourite and so on. I remember Indurain, of course, had this blueprint as well, of Giro Tour, and he did that twice, and then the third year he didn't win the Giro.
Same with Merckx as well. You know, Merckx, it all went wrong for Merckx in 1971 when he didn't do the Giro.
Yeah, that's right.
Just on that point, I mean, Rui Costa won the Tour of Switzerland 10 days before the Tour de France, and when you think about that now, how crazy it was that they sacrificed him really in favour of Valverde in the Tour. And next year, you know.
Well, Lampre, anything is possible. So my rider of the year, well, I was going to mention a couple, actually. I was going to mention Nairo Quintana and also Marcel Kittel, both young riders who really came of age this year. I'm kind of disappointed to hear that Quintana's going to target the Giro next year, because it would be great to see him, you know, having finished second in the Tour, there's only one thing to go back to the Tour for, and that's to try and win it. You know, it's great that riders target races other than the Tour, but I would love to see Quintana go back to the Tour and really take on Froome or whoever it happens to be. Could be a very good race actually at the Giro, though, between Quintana and Richie Port. It could be a very interesting battle. And then Marcel Kittel, who really, I think, at the Tour, for all that Mark Cavendish, as he explains in his book, was below par at the Tour, I think that Kittel, you know, proved that he is at least a formidable opponent for Cavendish, and looking ahead, that's going to be a great rivalry. He's just such an appealing personality as well, Kittel.
Just on Giro, Rich and Quintana riding that, I'm not insinuating that RCS are paying a Movistar a lot of money to take Quintana to the Giro, but I'm sure they would have been very, very keen.
Sounds like you are.
For someone, they'd been extremely keen for someone to bring their headline rider, because otherwise it's looking pretty bare, the Giro field next year, because Nibali won't be doing it, and you know, Richie Port is not a huge name internationally, so I think Quintana will add some much needed sort of sparkle dust there.
This is the Humans Invent Cycling Podcast with Richard Moore, Lionel Burney and Daniel Free.
Right, well, Ian mentioned earlier that Marianne Vos is his Rider of the Year, and I spoke to her recently, and here she is. So Marianne Vos, what are you looking at next year? Because you're so versatile, and this year you dabbled a bit away from the road. You were mountain biking, you're doing a bit of everything. What are your thoughts for next year?
Yeah, this year I was just trying to get into the mountain bike thing and to sort out if I was able to compete, to be competitive at the international level. And I'm still not there, but I'm trying to work on it. And it's really nice to have that challenge yourself. And it's a great sport.
Is it part of some ambitious plan for global domination, for even greater global domination? Do you want to go to the Olympics and maybe ride the mountain bike race and the road race?
That would be fantastic. Yeah. I've done track in Beijing. I've rode in Beijing and London. And to add an extra discipline to that would be cool. So I'm trying to get at that level, but I know it's going to be really difficult. And it's not to take over the world or to get to have global domination. I just like to have the challenge myself. Mm. And I'm not done with road cycling or cyclocross, because I still like it. And of course, I've won a lot, but still I like to go into the races and to improve myself. But it's good to have something new and something fresh to work on and to see, where I can end. And to have, I've doubts, but that motivates me to get
there. Well, I mean, there were some doubts before the road race, the World Road Race in Florence this year.
Yeah.
About whether you were the favourite or not, because you hadn't been focused all year on the road. Did you have those doubts as well? And were you surprised the way the race unfolded?
I had those doubts. During the season, I've had good races, but also not so good. And I haven't been as dominant as the years before. And that's not bad. That's okay. And I was ready for that because of the mountain bike thing. And I was trying to do everything and to fit in everything in a year. And then you're not at top shape all the time. But I was having some problems during the season and not at the level I was hoping for. And then, I was not really sure about the World Championships. But the weeks before, I was getting better and better. And I thought, I'm okay, and I'm able to race for the win. We had a strong team. The circle was okay, but still, I knew it would be really hard. And the other teams, the other countries and riders, they want to win too. Really tough competition this year. The Italians were strong, and America had a really strong team. And then you have the individuals Emma Johansson, especially the Italian teams with the different riders and everyone that could win actually the world championships in a team that's really hard to compete against. Mm.
You were also behind moves this year to try and improve the situation for women cyclists and the petition for the Women's Tour de France as well. Mm-hmm. You know what? Where is that campaign now? And are you optimistic, especially with a change of leadership at the UCI, that things might improve for women over the next couple of years?
Yeah, well, actually, I'm really happy with where we are now. But, of course, still things can improve. And the petition was good to get the talk going about women cycling and what needs to happen to improve and to get it more and more professional and to get it at the level that we want, more equal to the men. And, of course, I'm aiming for more races together with the men, because all cycling world is there, the crowds are there, the media is there, But to have a big event only for women, that can be a change, actually.
Because sometimes, you know, Tour of Flanders, Flesh Wallonne, there's the combined events. Does that work, do you think? Because as you say, the world, the media are there. Does that work, or does the women's race get a little bit lost there?
Until now it gets a little bit lost, but we're getting more and more attention, and it's nice for us to race with so many spectators. In these races we can make a change just to get more attention and to get the media more involved. And at this moment they're still focused on the men's race. But we're having a really exciting race before. But it's not in video, it's not shown somewhere, and it's hard because it's at the same time. But when we are in the final, it's still not the final for the men. They're still before, and I think that adds value for the day and also for the television. If you have an exciting final for women just before the men enter the final, it's more interesting to watch.
And have you met Brian Cookson before? Or would you like to meet him?
I met him this year at the Red Commission in Geneva. Yeah, it was good to meet him.
Yeah,
and then I'm really positive about him and about how he sees cycling and how he sees the things and the things that can change. So for women's cycling, I think, yeah, he can do something good.
And how's the sport in Holland? Because obviously it's been through a difficult year with Rabobank pulling out the men's sport. But are they committed to the women's team? And how do you feel what's the state of the sport at the moment?
When Rabobank stepped out of women of professional cycling, and actually on that day they already said we'll continue with the women's team and until Rio. So that was for 4 more years, and that's really nice to hear, because then you have the trust from the sponsor and you can work on a 4-year plan with a nice team. And of course, I was worried about the situation of cycling in general at that moment. I was worried. I was thinking, how should we get the trust from the public back? And
you're the number one woman in the world. Does that suspicion impact on the women as well, or do you think it was restricted to men's cycling?
It was about cycling in general, and it was harmed at that moment. But actually, for now, it has changed. I thought it would take years to get out of that depression. But now we're 1 year further, and I can't even imagine we were there last year. So it's really good. And of course, in the beginning, everybody was asking, well, what do you think about the situation? And you win that much, how is that possible? But I'm really happy. I'm trying to show that it's great to do the sport and how fantastic the sport is. I can only be happy with a win if I do it in an honest way, and I share that feeling. And I really think people see that and see how I see the sport, and it's getting better.
And how about next year? Will we see you at the Women's Tour of Britain? That's a sort of major new event for next year. Are you planning to ride?
It has a good place on the calendar, and I'm really looking forward. For sure. It will be a great event.
You're listening to the Humans Invent Cycling Podcast, powered by Sharp.
That was Marianne Vos. We're going to take a little interlude here before we go on to our final two categories to have a little chat with Ian about a huge tome he's brought, and I think you're going to also donate this as a prize to our listeners, Ian.
Yes, indeed.
It's the Ruler Annual, which is a bit of a tradition, an institution, some would say, but it's a bit different this year. Can you tell us how you've done it this year?
Yeah, it's very different. I don't know, we felt like we were in a little bit of a groove, and so we had this crazy idea. We thought we'd send everybody we could possibly muster to the Tour de France, so we sent 7 photographers, 7 writers, and divvied out 3 stages each. Just got in touch with the guys and girls and said, tell me what your story is. As long as it's something totally different from what everyone else is doing, then great.
So it's the story of the tour, but it's not really the story of the tour. It's a very kind of unusual take on it.
we just made sure everybody's got a totally different angle on it. I went with Sean Kelly and Carlton Kirby in the Eurosport cabin, in the commodious Eurosport cabin, and just sort of saw what they got up to.
And obviously the photographs are you know, there are lots of photographs of cyclists.
There are lots of photographs of cyclists.
A new departure for Roulard.
There's quite a few of us. Some of them smiling, some of them grimacing.
And some in colour.
Yeah.
No, it's lovely to, I mean, because it was a great tour, actually. And
it was a great tour.
And it's lovely to flick through the book and be reminded of, you know, these are certainly not the obvious images. These are not images that you'll have seen from this tour, and some of the pictures from Corsica in particular really do bring back just how spectacular that was.
Yeah. So
well, even those of us who were there, you almost didn't realise when you were stuck on the Mega Smeralda. Yeah. When you were stuck on a boat for much of it, you didn't. It was hard to appreciate how stunning that landscape was. Yeah. And it's great to relive that through some of these pictures.
And then each chapter's got their own writer as well. So there's people like Richard Williams and Guy, of course, the editor, and so everybody's taking their own angle on the writing as well. Just whatever floats their boat and tells a story.
Lionel's flicking through as we speak. Those are the sound effects. What do you think, Lionel?
It's beautiful. It's a beautiful looking thing. Congratulations to everyone who's put it together. I'm looking at it and just thinking, yeah, there are things that are kind of a left field. Having been there for all bar Corsica, it's the tour that we kind of get a glimpse of, but don't really. I'm looking at the picture there of, I think that's Alpe d'Huez, isn't it?
Yeah.
The crowd,
yeah,
and we obviously drove through those crowds, and then
you're spending quite a lot of time on that female Japanese fan there, but
purely by coincidence. But yeah, it's kind of it is a bit left field in places, isn't it? But it's all the better for that, I think.
And you're gonna give us one of these as a prize, Ian,
yes,
for our competition.
Yes,
we'll add that to our pile of prizes.
Question.
Wonderful, right. Wonderful, yeah. Well, maybe we should do a separate competition for that. You think of a question.
What number annual is this?
What number ruler annual is this? And the winner, which will be picked at random, it'll not be the first correct answer, but it'll be picked from a hat. Will receive a copy of the Ruler Annual. Please tweet at HumansInvent hashtag Ruler Competition. Ruler Competition. So it's also a bit of a spelling test as well.
The Cycling Podcast with HumansInvent.com. Innovation, craftsmanship and design.
Competition time. Finally, we have a winner of our latest Mystery Voice competition. There were an awful lot of entries, a lot for Tyler Farrar, Tyler Hamilton, Floyd Landis, Greg Henderson, you name it. If they were Australian or American, they were nominated. But we had one winner, and that was Scott Denny from Callander in Scotland. Well done, Scott. You correctly named the mystery voice as Joe Dombrowski, the young Team Sky Neo Pro this year. So this was Joe Dombrowski.
But now, as more and more comes out, it seems like, it's like, what can you really believe in?
So well done, Scott Denny. You win a copy of my book, Tour de France 100, plus all three cycling anthologies, volumes 1, 2 and 3, for correctly identifying the mystery voice as Joe Dombrowski. So we have a new competition now. Same again, if you can guess the mystery voice from the following clip.
You should have become the fool.
So that was our new mystery voice. If you can correctly identify the owner of that voice, please tweet at HumansInvent, hashtag mystery voice. If you get it based on that brief clip this first week, you will win a copy of my book, Sky's the Limit. We'll add to the prize every week if nobody gets it. So again, it's at HumansInvent, hashtag Mystery Voice. And here's the clip again.
You should have become the fool.
The HumansInvent Cycling Podcast. For more articles, go to humansinvent.com/cycling.
Story of the year. I'm going to go first.
Go.
The Wiggins and Froome soap opera. I think there's still so much more to come out about this. There are rumours about what went on at the World Championships, on the eve of the World Championships, about rumoured proffered handshakes, rejected handshakes, shoes being knocked off radiators, all kinds of stories. All kinds.
Shoes on the radiator.
Yeah, shoes on the radiator. All kinds of rumours. And I love it. The Froome-Wiggins soap opera didn't actually come to any resolution this year, apart from maybe in Florence. We don't know yet. we haven't had it confirmed yet, but you know, they didn't line up together at the tour. Will they next year? You know, there'll be huge pressure on Team Sky to select Bradley Wiggins, you would have thought, next year for the tour that starts in Yorkshire. So I think that, you know, Bradley Wiggins has got one more year of his contract to go. I think that'll again be an interesting little subplot to next season, but I enjoyed it this year. Lionel?
Well, I would say it's got to be the Quintana homecoming after the tour, because with all the talk of how cycling must be a, you know, the UCI's obsession with taking cycling to new territories, ignoring the fact that Colombia had already had a very high profile kind of period of greatness in the 80s with Lucho.
And a long history.
And a long history with a great race of its own, great races of its own. But their riders first came over here in the 80s and over here to Europe in the 80s to the Tour de France. Herrera, Fabio Parra, and then later on Mejia and
Rincon,
one or two others. But seeing the pictures and the footage of Quintana's homecoming, and just seeing, you know, what an extraordinary number of people turned out, and the pictures of him with his family and all of his family in tears. You know, there's just something about that that really appealed, because it was, you know, taking the Tour de France back to Colombia, you know, a small town in Colombia, and it being the centre of their world for 3 weeks in July. And I think for all the talk about globalisation and taking the sport to other areas of the world and making it more popular, this often kind of gets overlooked, because, you know, Colombia isn't a Middle Eastern oil-rich state. Millions to
there should be a world tour race in Colombia, in fact, to reflect the rich, very rich cycling culture that there is there.
Absolutely.
Ian, story of the year? Do you have a story of the year?
I do have a story of the year, although it's kind of it's a non-story, but I'd like to make it a story. Brian Cookson's salary at the UCI. It came out the other week how much he gets paid, and yeah, 76. K less than...
Is that more than deputy editor ruler?
Slightly, yeah.
As much as one of these andors.
No, but what amazed me was there didn't seem to be any comment about it, how much he gets paid, and yet it was all about, he's taken 76 less than McQuaid.
I thought it was a staggering sum of money.
I was absolutely gobsmacked. You know, so twice as much as the Prime Minister.
I was going to say, yeah.
But the story was that McQuaid, because I went to, actually interviewed him at the Cyclocross Worlds in 2000 and start of 2012, and one of my questions was, you know, why are you not transparent about the salary? For Brougham was not a salaried president. McQuaid was the first salaried president of the UCI, and he said, his answer was that the salary of the chief executive of a non-listed private company is up to us whether we reveal that. And he said, but it is in line with the sort of salary you'd expect from an organisation of a similar size. So I looked at the accounts and sort of worked out roughly what it could be, judging by the UCI's wage bill. And so when it was revealed, one of Cookson's points was that he would reveal what the UCI president was paid.
I don't know what Cookson's finances were before, but that would be a massive step up for him personally.
Oh, absolutely.
I mean, huge, you know, by multiples of
several. I do appreciate that he is in line with what the head, you know,
In a private corporate.
As opposed to a public. I mean, I appreciate that's the kind of money they get.
The disconnect here is that people assume that the UCI is some kind of public body, there for the, you know, elected by the public to do something. It's not at all. It's a self-appointed private body, and it can do what it likes. And I think one of the things that gets completely lost in all of the debate about McQuaid's presidency and the fact that that had more than run its course is that people demand of it the same transparency they would demand of a government, and for no other reason other than because it runs a sport that we all love. And I think that's one of the biggest hurdles that Brian Cookson's got to get over and try and change. I mean, he could become somebody in sort of the landscape of global sports administration, you know, a truly groundbreaking person. Mm. He could break down these walls that surround the IOC and FIFA and UEFA and all of these other companies they're all based around one lake in Switzerland, and they're all being very secretive.
I think we're all, you know, we also quite supportive of Brian Cookson, and having known him for a few years and found him to be a straight sort of guy. A slightly discordant note for me was struck at the World Cup recently in Manchester, where one of the podium presentations was conducted. Well, one of the sort of guests on the podium for one of the medal ceremonies was Mike Lee, who effectively ran Cookson's campaign. Mike Lee of Vero Communications, who's this strategist who has run several successful bids for World Cups and so on, and Olympic bids and so on. And I just thought, should Mike Lee be up there presenting medals to World Cup winners over volunteers or, you know, other stalwarts of British cycling or of world cycling? That jarred a bit with me, I must admit. But anyway, going off on a bit of a tangent there, Daniel, what's your story of the year?
I think it was Filippo Pozzato's relentless self-deprecation, mainly using the medium of Twitter throughout the year. And this started with him crossing the line at Roma Maxima, which was the old Giro del Lazio reinvented, arms aloft, not realising that I think it was Bilal Kadri of AG2R was down the road. And most riders would have been mortified by this, but over the past few years, Pozzato has gradually been kind of warming to the role of kind of parody of himself, this sort of bronze, preening, Monaco dwelling, complete no-hoper. And he seems to absolutely revel in
wonderful collection of tattoos.
A wonderful collection and a growing collection of tattoos. He seems to absolutely revel in this. And in fact, throughout the year, you know, people were sending messages of encouragement along the lines of, you know, hope you go well today at the Giro, hope you finally get the win you deserve. And Pozzato would reply, pigs might fly. No chance of that.
Wonderful.
And then he finally did win a race. I forget which one it was, but it was one of the sort of Italian, late summer Italian semi-classics.
He's at Lampre. They're contractually obliged not to win races there, are they not?
Yeah.
Help Ray Costa's check the small print. Right, let's just wrap up this year review podcast with a very quick confession of the year. Lionel, what's your confession of the year?
Why the bag, Michael Rasmussen's.
Why the bag, Michael Rasmussen.
In confession, and neatly done on television, and in 288 hardback pages. And I did read, I don't know whether this is true, that he had a book signing and only three people turned up. And I think that is starting to show that we've gone over the summit of the confessions now. Mm. Next year will not be the year of the confession. Mm. Sure.
I think it'll be a bumper year of confessions next year.
Oh, really?
Do you confess and Strictly Come Dancing?
Okay.
You imagine this particularly spectacular kind of...
Ian, confession of the year.
I've lost count. I don't know. I'm bored. I'm just bored.
Daniel?
I think mine is Lionel's, that he never wanted to travel on Tour de France with you again because you're always late and you're an incredibly messy eater.
I think you just made that bit up, Daniel. I
was racking my brain to think whether I had said that.
You've not said. My confession of the year is Peter Sagan's video apology for pinching the podium girl's bottom at the Tour of Flanders.
Yeah.
That's a good quiz question.
She works for the organisation. Yeah.
Okay, excellent. Well, did you all enjoy this season? Did you all enjoy the podcast?
Hey, for some of us, the season's in full swing.
Back to that.
It must be bad for you roadies, you know, you get to October and nothing to do until February.
As we've just proved, there's still lots to talk about. Thank you very much, Ian, for joining us.
Thank you.
I don't think it's Christmas time yet, Daniel. Hold your horses. No. Ian, thank you for joining us. Thank you for bringing in this booty. And Lionel, thank you.
Thank you, Richard.
Daniel, thank you.
Thank you, Rich.
The Humans Invent Cycling Podcast. Interviews and analysis. We've got the big talking points covered.
Menards 11% rebate is here. From lighting to lumber, from doors to floors. The bigger the project, the bigger the rebate. From painting projects to that new kitchen makeover and designing that outdoor space of your dreams. Save big on any project you're tackling. Hurry into Menards for an 11% rebate on everything. Mail-in rebate is a merchandise credit check, not a point-of-sale discount. Redeemable on future in-store purchases only. Not on future purchases on Menards.com. See store for details. Save big.